Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus, global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Disney shares falling the most in, I think, about 6 months. We definitely saw a bunch of selling today. It was really concerns, once again, about subscribers in its namesake streaming service. They also predicted a wider loss in that business this quarter. So let's get to it. Let's talk about the quarter. Let's talk about the business. We've got a great roundtable. David Trainer is chief executive of New Constructs, former stock analyst on Wall Street. He now has a robo-analyst technology that looks at companies, goes through it, tells us, makes sense about valuation and balance sheets. And Mark Douglas is with us, president and CEO of Amountain. It's an ad software company. It really works with brands to move into revenue and streaming TV and site visits and all this good stuff. So it's
really Mark D.
I'm trying to set the stage. So let's get to it, guys. David, I want to start with you. Your thoughts just initially coming off of Disney, what they said last night on the call, what stands out?
Yeah, I think that Disney is doing the right thing and de-emphasizing Disney Plus. I mean, look, streaming was never meant to be a moneymaker. Netflix has burned billions. They've never actually turned a cash profit in the streaming business. And I think Disney has rightly recognized that streaming is just another way to get customers into the top of their funnel so that they can monetize those folks downstream in their other much more profitable businesses like parks and merchandising. And that's a very unique advantage that Disney has. They actually make a lot of money in their other businesses that they can afford to have streaming as a loss leader, whereas Netflix and some of these other pure streaming plays cannot.
So, Mark, this is really interesting because I live it, right? My daughter watches Frozen and Moana on repeat, and then she begs me to take her to the toy store and spend much more money on the products from those two films.
Just wait till you go to the Disney parks.
And she wants to go to the parks because of them. So What David's saying makes a heck of a lot of sense to me. I'm much poorer for the streaming service. What do you think?
Well, I think ultimately, Pete, you have to buy products, not stocks, in the sense of the stocks that have the best products are what you buy. Consumers want streaming. So I don't quite agree with the idea that Disney should move away from what its customers want. They want on-demand content. They want a big choice in the content. And I think Disney and other companies, they figured out how to make that profitable on linear television. And I think there's no reason they won't figure out how to do that profitably on streaming. They're definitely going through a transition, and that trend from linear to streaming, and that transition has a lot of costs associated with it. But if you want to be involved in Disney long term, you have to believe in all the streaming products, the park products, the cruise products, and all the other, ESPN and all of that. So I think streaming is potentially the most important part of Disney, because the migration from linear to TV is on the level of 1 million households a month.
Well, David,
the size of Phoenix a month.
David, come back. Are you saying Disney should be out of streaming, or that you say it makes sense,
no,
but it's because it's a funnel into everything else?
Yeah. And I think we're really on the same page here.
Okay.
I'm not saying that they should get rid of it. I think they should de-emphasize and not throw money after it like crazy, like Netflix did for years, right? And sort of Netflix and Salesforce were sort of these original business models that were built on an unlimited amount of capital to burn in the hopes of building a large enough customer base that they could eventually monetize that in a profitable way. That's not working for either business. And I think the good news is that Disney's not trying to do that. They do need it. It is a new channel. There's no question streaming around to stay, for sure. But don't go chasing streaming to the point where you're trying to acquire unprofitable customers.
But you do think it's a loss leader, though, right, David? So you think, for example, investors sell the stock when they see subscriber numbers fall, streaming subscriber numbers fall. And you're saying, hey, those subscribers are expensive as hell. So if I see a few of them fall away in a quarter or two, it's not going to bother me.
That's exactly what I'm saying. So I'm saying, because a lot of these losses were in India and non-U.S. And those are the least profitable customers. They're money losers. And so it's just time to get rational in the business, because Netflix set an example being so irrational because they were using capital as a weapon, which meant they could spend unlimited amounts of money to just go acquire customers for the sake of showing customer growth. Remember when everyone talked about Netflix, it was always about customer growth and nothing about profits, right? Now we're talking about profits, and so they're boasting customer declines, and that's because you shouldn't chase unprofitable customers. That doesn't mean the channel goes away. It just means it becomes more rational.
Now, Netflix is actually up today, or was up in the cash session, almost 3%. And I don't want to completely, change the subject of the conversation here. But Mark Douglas, do you think Netflix still has a future? I mean, I think I believe that David's position is Netflix is going to cash burn itself out. Do you think Netflix is going to be able to cut costs and make money at some point? Because they haven't really generated free cash flow thus far.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely, given their scale, the opportunity to cut costs. I agree with what's being said in terms of different markets have different unit economics. And you kind of have to make a clear choice as to which of those economics that you want to pursue. I think the big thing for Netflix is how all in are they going to go in terms of ad-supported model. And, if the streaming model, the unit economics, at least in some markets, it hasn't been the greatest, but the opportunity to sell ads against that content, I think, is a boost to the brand. It brings in more of those subscribers. And even with their core subscribers, I mean, there's an opportunity to essentially do price increases through, basically the inclusion of ads at some point. And maybe you trade, a dollar or $2 of discount for $5, $6, $7 more of revenue over the month. But these things are hard to do. And I think
right.
I completely agree that the obsession with subscribers, it needs to stop. I think people actually want that because it's a reason to get the stock to swing and generate profits for short-term traders.
David, you've got this natural language processing technology formula. You can really look at Disney earnings, the quality of those earnings, and against its current valuation. When you do that, David, what does it tell you about Disney?
Well, Disney's economics are the worst they've been in a while. I think the double whammy of the Fox acquisition and COVID was rough. But we are seeing the margins and returns on capital turning back up. And I think with Bob Iger back in charge, we can expect to see that trend continue. And that's why we're bullish. We think if returns on capital get back to half of where they were, the stock's easily a $130 stock.
Mark? ESPN streaming, how valuable is that? Because you know that there's been pressure on Disney to kind of kick it out as a separate entity.
Yeah, I think it's critical to the brand. I mean, the one thing everyone should remember, more people watch television a day than use social media. And they spend three times as much time doing it too. They spend 59 minutes a day on TikTok and Meta. They spend 3 hours a day on television. So, the Disney brand is built on the broad appeal to a lot of consumers. A lot of that appeal starts with those television assets, those movie assets. So they're really critical to brand. I actually think long term, the biggest risk to Disney is the brand is associated with being magical, and they need to maintain that magic in terms of everything they're doing. So they have to balance the short term cost cutting with maintaining the magic. If to maintain the price points that they have, like at Disneyland, and with all these products, and maybe over time with the subscription services. So I think it's really critical for the long-term health of the Disney brand.
All right, guys, we got to leave it on that note. Really,
I didn't get to complain about ESPN Plus.
Well, you know what? We'll save that for next block.
Okay, I just want to complain because I don't get to see enough good games on ESPN Plus, and I don't have cable.
Help me. Is it Friday yet? David Trainer over at New Constructs, Mark Douglas at Mountain. We really appreciate you joining Matt and myself. You are listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week, and this is Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern.
Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app.
Or watch us live on YouTube.
We're going to take a step back from the markets for a moment to something I think it's safe to say that most of us have dealt with in our lives on some level, and that is hearing loss. About 2 to 3 out of every 1,000 children in the U.S. are born with a detectable level of hearing loss in one or both ears. More than 90% of deaf children are born to hearing parents, and roughly 15% of American adults, we're talking about more than 37 million age 18 and over, report some trouble hearing. So it's a big issue. So we wanted to get to it with Dr. Carrie Niemann, core faculty member for the Cochlear Center for Hearing and Public Health at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder, of course, of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. She is with us on Zoom from Bethesda, Maryland. Dr. Niemann, it is so nice to have you here with Matt and myself. It is a big issue. I certainly dealt with it with my aging dad. Went through hearing aids. It wasn't always such an easy process. But talk to us a little bit about...
That's why I'm so loud, by the way.
You are loud, man.
It's
oh
because...
My
God. Well, I know, but no. All joking aside, right? It's because I have pretty significant hearing loss. And...
Over time?
I just don't hear myself as well.
Were you born with or no?
No, I just ruined my hearing in my teenage years. And as a result, I guess, you know, the same thing happened to my dad. So it could be...
Genetic,
to some extent.
Dr. Niemann, come on in and kind of set the stage for us, because it apparently, like I said, it affects a lot of us.
Yeah, exactly. Almost all of us at some point in time are going to experience some degree of hearing loss. The thing that I think has really shifted and changed in the past 10 to 15 years is now how we think about hearing loss. We really no longer think about it as this just benign part of the aging process. It is, you know, something that we view and need to view right in the context of healthy aging. So if we all want a shot at aging as well as possible, it needs to be kind of in that long list of things that we're all thinking about as we age.
So how do people deal with it? If they have less money, you know, my mother-in-law, who lives in Spain, which is a socialist country, just spent 4,000 euros to buy hearing aids. And I was so, impressed with the price. I just couldn't believe it. Is that how much that kind of gear costs?
That's kind of what it cost my dad, I think, too.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. And that's certainly in line with what we see, what we've traditionally seen. The thing that has shifted in this, you know, really past year or so is the advent and the opening of over-the-counter hearing aids into the market. And so that's one important piece of the puzzle in terms of how do we make hearing care more affordable is by bringing the technology side of things down in terms of opening up that market. And so it's not dominated just by a few kind of players, but opening up to consumer electronics and many others to enter. But I think the important piece here is, yes, we have technology, but how do we connect older adults to that technology? And that's a lot of the work that I do in partnership with community partners and particular community health workers.
Yeah, and only if I wonder if this is going to be in the budget talks. I'm guessing not necessarily, like spending on this or providing. I say that, I'm bringing that up because the headline just crossed. President Biden's meeting with congressional leaders on the debt ceiling has been postponed. So it goes on. Business as usual sometimes, if you will, when it comes to Washington. But Dr. Niemann, no, I do think about this, right? Like it is so expensive and you do wonder what we're doing to somehow make it more affordable or is there something the government can do? I don't know. What's the answer here? How do you guys look at it?
How we look at it is, you know, we have this kind of new piece in terms of over-the-counter hearing technology, but it can be really hard to navigate in terms of where in the world do you even start in terms of Googling versus, you know, going to an audiologist versus going to an ENT, your primary care doctor, you know, where do we start? And so a lot of the work that we've done is saying, you know, how can we make this as easy as possible in terms of partnering with individuals in a community setting who can go through kind of a structured way in which they introduce somebody to a piece of technology and say, hey, this is how you learn how to use it. This is how we can get you set up and going. And, you know, we have seen results in our work that are comparable to what we see with gold standard hearing aids fit by an audiologist. And that's, you know, done, you know, in a community setting in partnership with community health worker, 2 hours using over-the-counter hearing technology. And so it's not only just the technology, but it's an openness to kind of new and different models of care that are going to need to come alongside.
So talk to us about the gear. The basic setup is, how much does it cost? Is it just like an amplifier that, you know, makes the sounds in your atmosphere louder? And can you get it at, you know, CVS or Duane Reade? What is this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep, 100%. So there are a lot of different options available. There are options that look like a headset that can be, you know, user-friendly for individuals who've, you know, had a stroke or have bad arthritis. And those can run around just $100. And they can work really well. But then there's obviously a lot of other devices that are ear level that look like a traditional hearing aid. And those are going to run more in line with around $300, $400 for one side, for one ear. So that is certainly some money, but it is definitely an improvement from the $4,000, you know, hearing aids that you may get, you know, through your audiologist or your ENT.
Can you just do one ear? I guess you can, right? Like if
yeah,
you just have problems.
For sure.
Yeah. What if you,
yeah,
wait,
I mean,
if you can't hear
ideally,
from, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Ideally it's two, you
yeah,
know, but
yeah,
if we're talking about nothing versus something, we'll always take something. And one is always better than none.
What about people born with hearing loss? You know, I did, years ago, I did a piece on cochlear implants for the deaf, and there was some debate in the community about whether or not that was even a good idea, because they don't and they don't want to really accept deafness as being something that needs to be fixed. On the other hand, we had a guest the other day who's had 90% hearing loss in his left ear since he was born, and he went and got a cochlear implant that he mm-hmm. says has just changed his life for yeah. the better.
So recently he got it?
Yeah, and he's 65 yeah. years old, and he wow. finally said, yeah. you know what? It's time. The technology's there, and he's bald anyway, so he just went and got one.
Yeah. No, so good question. A lot of what our work is focused on from kind of a public health perspective is really based on the numbers in terms of, you know, for sure, there, you know, we have individuals who are deaf, hard of hearing, who are born deaf. But that does represent a fairly small portion of the population in terms of, you know, those numbers you were citing in terms of in the millions. You know, that's primarily age-related hearing loss, and most of that is mild to moderate. And so solidly in the realm of individuals who generally want to stay within the hearing world and are looking for assistance and don't yet qualify for a cochlear implant. So it's really that group of individuals that we're looking, you know, that over-the-counter hearing aids and kind of these new and different delivery models are looking to help address.
Hey, before we go, and I'm thinking about this having dealt with, you know, aging parents and aging family members, the connection between hearing loss and depression or dementia for that fat matter.
Yep. So great question. There have been a lot of large population-based studies that have seen an association and really kind of repeatedly an association between things like hearing loss, dementia, cognitive decline. But the big question that really remains for a lot of us in the scientific realm is, have we seen data that shows us that if we take somebody who, you know, maybe doesn't have a depression or, you know, doesn't have dementia and or, you know, mm-hmm. give them a hearing aid, can we slow that cognitive decline or can we, you know, improve their depression and do that in kind of a structured, rigorous fashion? And so that is happening and ongoing right now in terms of some of the larger trials. And we're really excitedly waiting the results of that, which are expected out this year in terms of 2023. So a lot more to come there. But that's exactly the type of thing that we're thinking about when we're saying hearing loss matters.
Well, so appreciate catching up with you. Thank you so much. Really important, certainly. Dr. Carrie Niemann, she's core faculty member of the Cochlear Center for Hearing and Public Health at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, as we remind you, supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. But so do you ever think about that you might need hearing aids at some point?
I think I definitely will. Mm. You know, my dad has gotten them, and I think it's interesting that you bring up the connection between hearing loss and dementia or hearing loss and depression, because I have seen that firsthand, and
mm-hmm,
the turnaround is pretty marvelous. So I think people just don't think about it and they don't make time to go and deal with this kind of thing because they think, I can't hear that very well. No big deal. It is a big deal, and it's better if you take care of it.
Because you're really, you know, kind of excluded if you can't hear. And so it's a really important issue.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline, it's teamwork, and it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
We want to talk to a company and to its head. They actually reported earnings this week. They are about a $2.9 billion market cap app location software and cloud company. We're talking about DigitalOcean Holdings. First quarter revenues met estimates. As for the overall report, though, Barclays said the results were somewhat mixed, and we're looking at a stock that's up about 25% so far here in 2023. Yancey Spruill is CEO at DigitalOcean, joining us on Zoom from Boulder, Colorado. Yancey, it is nice to have you here with Matt and myself. Before we start and get into the quarter and the business, just remind our world exactly what you guys do. Application software covers an awful lot.
It sure does, and great to be with you. We're a cloud infrastructure company, which means we have a dispersed set of computer and other storage assets around the world, and we rent access to the nearly 700,000 customers around the world, 185 countries. And so they can rent access to our cloud infrastructure to achieve their compute needs versus owning their own computer equipment around the world. So
a lot of them startups?
Yeah, we focus mainly on early stage businesses. So people who have ideas, developers who are testing ideas, and they graduate into about 140,000 of those 700,000 customers are running small emerging startup businesses on the platform. And why they come to us is it's simple, easy, intuitive to use. We provide a lot of support and documentation. And
they don't have to spend on it then, right?
Yeah, and then the last piece is it's cheap, you know, relative to other alternatives.
So how do you keep it cheap relative to the alternatives? Because I would imagine scale allows costs to be dropped. So what do you do to fight AWS and Microsoft?
Yeah, we certainly don't have the scale of some of the Microsoft, et cetera, those folks. But, you know, we are very large customers of some of the large hardware providers. And, you know, we over this 11-year history of our company have become very good operators. We're getting better over time. And also, so that's important, operational excellence. And that's an ongoing thing. The other thing is we are very tailored our product applications to a narrower set of customers, which is the SMB, small, medium-sized businesses, early stage startups, which is about $100 billion market size. It's a much smaller market than the big players play that focus on enterprise. So because we are focused on a smaller end of the market, simplicity of the product set allows us to not have to invest in a broad, diverse set of applications to cover the breadth of an enterprise market. And that keeps costs down as well because we can be very focused in our applications that we offer customers.
Yancey, what impact have you seen in your demand flows, if you will, coming off of the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank, if you're working with startups in that space, I'm just curious what impact you've seen.
Well, I wouldn't say, you know, one of the things we've seen over the last year is a slowing in the broader economy. I don't know that we've seen any change over the last 6 weeks since that bank. 70% of our customers are outside the United States. Mm-hmm. Most of our customers are bootstraps. You know, they have a day job and then they start a business at night. And when it gets of scale, they can pay for their own bills. They quit their day job. So they're not part of that institutional capital market. So we saw very little impact, had very little exposure, both directly as a business, but also in terms of our customers, and saw no real disruption, you know, over the last couple of months as that's all played out.
So I imagine you have server farms probably in more than one location. Talk to us about where you set up your gear and what kind of energy bills do you pay? You know, we've seen the costs really fluctuate, but last summer, for example, very expensive.
Well, we're in 50 different locations around the world: New York, Singapore, Frankfurt, Sydney, Toronto, San Francisco, India, Bangalore, India.
All right, you don't have to name them all, Yancy.
Yeah, right. So we're all over the place, and we serve customers all over. We have a very high capability network, and you know, power energy is a big cost. We talked about that in the last earnings call earlier this week, that we are paying slightly higher power costs in Europe because of the anticipated higher costs that we're going to be there because of what's going on in Ukraine. Obviously, that hasn't played out, so hopefully that will dissipate over time. But it's a big cost. You know, one of the good things about our business is we have Moore's Law playing it, in that, you know, efficiencies being built into the chips, into the technology. They get smaller, they consume less power over time. We work very closely with our data. We self host, so we mm-hmm. have third-party data centers,
right?
And we work with them on their strategies for energy efficiency. So I think we have a good plan going forward, and actually a good footprint today, and we have tailwinds at our back just given the nature of technology, how it evolves. But power is a meaningful cost for us in our footprint today.
You mentioned 70% of your customers are outside the United States. Is it largely in Europe? Is there a specific region of the world? And I'm just, no, you're shaking your head. So you talked about all the centers you have. So what does it tell you then about kind of what's going on in the global economy? You said things have been slowing down over the past year. Are they continuing to slow down?
You know, the beauty of our business is because we have such an easy way for customers to come to and sign up to be a customer on our website. 10 million people come to our website a month. Tens of thousands become paying customers every month. So very efficient. We get people from all over the world. And so we're split roughly Europe, Asia, United States, North America, and the rest of the world. It looks like GDP. So we truly are a reflection of entrepreneurial activity happening all over the world. We also don't have a lot of customer or industry concentration.
Right. But you still see things slowing.
We're seeing very consistent trends across the world.
All right. Got to run. Yancy, thank you so much. Yancy Spruill, he's Chief Executive Officer at DigitalOcean, joining us on Zoom from Boulder, Colorado. As we said, this stock is up about 26% this year.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Hi, I'm Ron Kruszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec on Bloomberg Radio.
Listen.
All right, we are going to talk about secrets. The new issue of Bloomberg Businessweek, it's out on newsstands, online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek, and of course on the Bloomberg. The cover story is about an iconic brand with a closely guarded secret recipe. We know about that, but we're going to tell you about the plot to steal the other secret inside a can of Coca-Cola. Writing about it, the Bloomberg team of Drake Bennett and Jordan Robertson. Drake is Bloomberg Businessweek technology reporter here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio, along with the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek, Joel Weber. And Joel, this is another heist story. You guys are good with these.
Heist. Well,
that's a funny little inside joke between Drake and me. Yeah, it is. And even more than that, it's a story about kind of the Chinese industrial complex looking for IP. And this culminated in a cover story that Jordan and Drake did together last year around GE. And that was a miraculous story. That had a real cat and mouse game. And if you haven't read that one, you should go back and read it. But you should also read this one because it centers on yet another big secret, which is what's inside a Coke can, but not the liquid. Turns out the liner,
right.
Drake Bennett,
right,
is
right.
incredibly valuable as well.
Yeah, and potentially more useful because if you didn't have this 2-micron thick polymer liner in your Coke can, the Coke would basically devour the can.
So, not just Coke, though, right? Because a lot of sodas would devour a can if they didn't have this liner.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So the liners, which are made by like BASF, Dow Chemical.
Yeah. Akzo Nobel, Sherwin-Williams.
So these liners are probably used by, I'm guessing, other soda makers besides Coca-Cola.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Coke occupies a particularly important position in this market because they're such a giant. So when they decide, you know, they're going to use something or not use something, it basically decides whether that thing has a market. So that happens to be the thing that this woman at the center of our story took advantage of, because she was a chemist at Coke, and she was responsible for deciding or helping decide which of these new coatings would go into Coke cans or not. And she uses this to basically get a lot more of this information than anyone at Coke had ever been able to get, and then takes it to try to start her own.
Don't give it all away. We got to slow this down. We got some time together here.
There's so much to talk about, right? She's one of only.
She?
Yeah. She's only one of only two people that had access.
Can we give her a name?
Yeah, Shannon Yeo. She's a Chinese-born chemical engineer, a very talented one with actually like a bunch of cool patents to her name. And she had this job at Coke where she was basically the gatekeeper to something called the Scientific and Regulatory Affairs Group, which is this sort of group that approves these things. And she was the contact person with these big chemical, these big coatings companies. Part of what was fun about the story was just like learning about all these cool coatings out there in the world on like stealth bombers and computer keys and things like
that. Can we talk about that for a second? Because it turns out everything in the world actually has a secret coating on it that we don't know about.
Sidebar.
Yeah, yeah. All these, you know, if you think about it, there's all these like interfaces in the world where like you're touching a thing or like, you know, there's a bridge and it's in like salty air, so the paint needs to prevent it from rusting. Or, you know, there's my favorite actually was this paint for ship hulls that basically like has the like a biocide in it that kills barnacles so that these ships can go back and forth across the ocean and barnacles can't attach to
them. We put it on our boat.
I wish I had that on my dad's boat when I was a kid. I just scraped the thing and repaint it every year.
It's pretty amazing. It's what you do. Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
And it turns out like this is what chemists do at big corporations, right? Is like work on these incredibly complicated formulas and massive IP that's caught up with that. And you think about that within a company, like it was only a few people that I mean, it makes me wonder if two people have the secret for the this formula, how many people have it for the Coke
right.
formula,
right? Right, yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, exactly.
Secret football suitcase for that? Right. I don't know.
It's actually in a vault.
Okay, well, there you go.
Yeah. I mean, there's a whole, like, staginess around that trade secret, I feel like.
Yes, very much so.
But, yeah, so anyway, so, yeah, so basically, and the... I mean, one of the other cool things about this coating is it has to get sprayed on in these cans that are like going at super high speeds through these giant. So there's all these sort of technical problems that these companies had to solve, and they spent tens of millions of dollars over many years to get these coatings just right. And the other bit of it, if you want to get into it, is that these particular ones were particularly valuable and new because they had gotten BPA out of them, yeah. which is something that we're increasingly trying to get out of things that touch
BPA is like a plasticky substance that, yeah. what does it cause cancer if we're exposed to it for too long?
And there's some research that suggests that it messes with your endocrine system. So it can give you diabetes, it can sort of cause...
So can Coke.
Right. If
consumed in yes. large,
right.
too
right.
large of quantities.
And consumed, exactly. if consumed in American level quantities, right? right?
Yeah. yeah, exactly.
So she was a great colleague, it turns out.
Yeah, right. No, exactly. I mean, part of what's kind of particularly like colorful about the story we felt is that if you were trying to do something like what she was trying to do, which is basically like squirrel away these incredibly valuable trade secrets from your employer, like you'd try to be presumably like chill yeah. about it. But she was actually this incredibly obstreperous personality, and everyone at any place she'd ever worked with was like, yeah, she was just always like really loud and really like getting into these arguments and had these like very contentious relationships with the companies whose IP she was like trying to steal, basically. So it's not one of those things where, like, you know, after the crime, everyone's like, wow, you know, I never thought he, you know, he seemed like such a nice boy.
Such a quiet
you
know? Guy.
Yeah, exactly. I never saw it. Yeah, exactly. They're like, no, that yeah. one over there.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're like, of course it was Shannon.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. She
did get fired. They fired her, though, before. So maybe if yeah. they hadn't fired her, she wouldn't have tried to steal their IP.
Well, actually, yes. And so that is actually something that her family members mentioned in the sort of sentencing letters they wrote to the judge after she was convicted, which is that, yeah, she would have... they say, you know, stated Coke and, you know, made her career there. I mean, that's complicated by the fact that she had been... So the other part of this is that all along, or basically through the entire period she's working at Coke and then afterward when she goes to work at Eastman Chemical, she's having these conversations with these business partners, including some relatives in China, about starting her own competing coatings company to bring these new high-tech coatings to China where there is not... a sort of domestic producer of these things. So it's this giant unmet need. There's a lot of public money that they can get to do this. And so there's this kind of parallel thing going on that emerges, you know, only when the FBI gets their hands on all of her electronic devices, where she's got this whole plan going at the same time. And that's why she needs this IP.
Thousand Talents program. This has come up in many other stories, not totally new here, but what concerns do American corporations have about things like Beijing's Thousand Talents program?
So Thousand Talents is probably the best known of these sort of grant programs that the Chinese government has. Provincial governments have them. The national government has them. And ostensibly, they're basically a way to try to get these Chinese-born engineers and scientists who have gone abroad to get educated or to get these jobs at high-tech companies, to get them to come back and start Chinese companies. What they end up doing, according to their critics, is also functioning as these bounties for IP. So it's like, come back and start a company, but bring some like valuable IP with you from GE Aviation or from Coke or wherever you are now. And so this is what was
smart. Why wouldn't they do that?
Yeah, right. It's like exactly. It's just
why wouldn't
that's how business
every country
has worked
does it
internationally forever.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes. Yeah. Right. No, there's a long history of, you know, the United States did it, England did it. You know, you just go back. It's sort of what it's the way the game has been played. But right now, one of the ways the game is played is through these programs. And so Shannon and her co-founders got some of this money. They applied for it and they got it. For the purpose of starting up a BPA-free coating factory and lab in China.
I had this idea.
No. Yeah, right.
I may know some stuff.
Right, yeah. No, and it's like, you know, I mean, it was very important for the purposes of the application to say, like, here is the IP that we have. And, you know, they didn't, just to kind of, like, they had, it was for the application, they basically, she has an impressive resume, but they basically like gild the lily in all these amazing ways. They say she's like the CTO of a Fortune 500 company, which she wasn't. They say she actually invented these coatings, which she didn't. They produced this fake sort of licensing agreement that would have given them the rights to these technologies, which they didn't have. So there's a whole package that's very fraudulent that they used to get the money.
Okay, so she's got, you know, employers and employees who don't really like her. She's got this exit strategy in China.
Right.
How does that all come to a head?
Well, it comes to a head because, she basically keeps making such a spectacle of herself and being so sort of blatant about what she's doing that her employer after Coke, which is Eastman Chemical, sort of fires her. But even after that, she sort of keeps doing these things that raise these red flags. And so eventually they get their hand, they notice she's been like downloading these files onto a USB drive. And so they insist on getting that back when they fire her, and they find these Eastman files, but then all these other files from all these companies where she hasn't even worked before. And so then at that point, there's a guy at Eastman who used to work for the FBI, and he calls some of his old colleagues, and then it becomes a criminal thing.
Yeah.
And then the companies, the Akzo Nobels and the Sherwin Williams, find out that their secrets are out there, and they, so she gets in, at that point starts getting in big trouble.
One of my favorite details from this point in time, the NDAs that she got
right
wrapped up in, where she was getting companies to like do NDAs just for her, yeah, and then when Coke has to intervene, they have to like do NDAs to like supersede the NDAs.
It's
like
nuts. I think it's sort of, it's amazing how much she's able to do as this like kind of mid-level person at this company. And
there's hope for all of us out there.
Right.
I mean, she has a PhD, right? She went to Lehigh to get her doctorate.
We
educated her. I don't know if I should say it like that.
But the most fabulous thing becomes this FBI interrogation, right?
Right. One of the key pieces of evidence that gets referred to over and over again in her trial is this two-hour conversation she has right after she's arrested in Michigan at an FBI office there, where the lead investigator in the case basically kind of like walks her through. I mean, it's interesting. It's just kind of like a case study in how you do these things, because he sort of starts out, you know, with a bunch of like very innocent questions, and she's kind of basically lies about a lot of things, and then he sort of reveals, just because they've been in her WeChats, they've been in her like Gmail, they've been in her work, like they have her voicemails, they
know the story,
they
right?
know it, yeah. And so basically, and there's some part, it seems, where he's like sort of, the FBI agent is like floating the idea of trying to get her to maybe like roll over on her co-conspirators, but she doesn't seem very interested. So then it basically becomes him kind of confronting her with all these things that it's clear that she was doing,
which makes her fall pretty quiet, I think.
Yeah.
I would have asked for my lawyer a few hours before.
Never talk to the cops. It doesn't even matter how innocent you are. Yeah. Never, ever, 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 ever talk to the police.
They're not your friends. Anthony Messini, who oversees radio and more.
Audio, yeah.
He's like, when you're talking to Joel, like, what is it that made you greenlight this story?
So,
I got about 30, 40 seconds.
I love a good heist,
at the
end of the day, you know, IP is the most valuable thing that any of us kind of create for our companies, right? And our companies value that. And yet, you know, that is a thing that is very difficult to write about and talk about. So when you end up with a narrative and the drama around it and characters like Shannon Yeoh and what happens here, it just connects so many different pieces. So there's a very big story here, but we can tell it through, you know, something that's very dramatic and kind of small and invisible.
But super important and ubiquitous.
And invisible. Like, you would have never even known that coatings are worth this much money. And by the end of it, you're just like...
It's also an incredible multimedia story. The way you told it and the way you laid it out, you've got video in the text and obviously not in the magazine, but you can go to businessweek.com and get.
You can read it anywhere you want.
It's everywhere.
I usually like the paper magazine, but
that's my favorite way.
We got to go, guys. Joel Weber, editor of Business Week. Drake Bennett, he wrote it. This is Bloomberg Radio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus, global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving you crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, just about 17 and a half minutes left in today's trading session. Carol Messer, along with the sometimes shy and a little nervous Matt Miller. Hard to believe.
I'm never.
How many years have you been doing this?
23.
I know you were, you were just a wee one.
Yeah.
When we first met, you were over in Germany.
I had
London.
Hair.
He had lots.
You know?
He had Gordon Gekko hair.
I weighed 20 pounds less.
You were kind of a skinny little dude. Let's get to it, folks. Let's talk about the markets. That's what everybody wants to know. It's kind of, I've called it a meh week, and I feel like we're having another
I have to disagree with you there, as you
Why?
Know.
Because of the
Because there's been so much movement under the hood. So, yeah, we haven't seen a lot of...
Treasuries?
In stocks, too. If you have a behemoth like Disney, a $200 billion stock dropping 10% in a day, I mean, the volatility for individual names has been insane. But the thing is, it's been barbelled, right? So the index hasn't moved much at
S&P
all.
S&P is down just about quarter. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, so the S&P doesn't move
so
a lot.
I'm
but
looking
these...
at big picture.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
I'm looking more granularly.
Katie Kaminsky is like, these two idiots, will they finally get to me? Katie is Chief Research Strategist and Portfolio Manager at Alpha Simplex Group. She joins us via Zoom from Boston. Katie, it's been that kind of a week. Matt is not wrong. Underneath, like look at regionals or some, underneath there's a lot of stuff going on. Big picture, it doesn't feel. How do you make sense of this trade?
Well, I'll just be honest, we've been treading water. And for most of the, technical traders and quantitative traders out there, the signals are super mixed. And it feels like the world is waiting for a data point to tell us where we're going. And I think that's what's been so hard.
I mean, like an economic data point or a market data? Yeah. Okay.
I mean, I feel like it's anything. I don't know. I mean, every single data point, you start the week and it goes CPI on Wednesday. And everyone's like, okay, it's going to come out. And then things
And then
change.
Nothing happens,
do
right?
Something. And then nothing happens.
We're all waiting for options expiries all of a sudden.
I'm
again,
waiting.
Right?
I'm
and
waiting.
Then nothing happens.
I'm waiting for the X date. I don't know about you guys.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, and then it's like this debt ceiling stuff. And it's just.
Exactly.
It feels like somebody just tell us, like, where is it going to go? And from our side, the signals are so mixed and the markets are basically disagreeing. So equities and bonds don't always agree. And it's real confusing, to be honest.
This is what I want to ask you. This is what you guys do. You look into market behavior. That's what you study. And you study investment risk. And you share that with your clients. So I am curious, are you just telling your clients, folks, we really don't know what's going on?
Well, I don't think anyone knows perfectly what's going on here. But what we're telling them is that signals are mixed. And when you look at the net positioning in equity markets, it sort of disagrees with the net positioning in fixed income. Mm. And if you look at the shape of the yield curve, it's still inverted. And people are optimistic on a pause, but at the same time, they're saying, well, but we're going to have cuts right away, which is also confusing. So I think that's where right now what we are seeing from a technical perspective is views are definitely conflicting.
If it's we get cuts, here. I mean, wouldn't it be terrifying if the Fed if this Federal Reserve feels it has to cut rates in 2023, that means something awful happened.
Exactly. And I think that's why I'm surprised, because when you think of it from a more rational perspective and looking at the shape of the yield curve, either we haven't priced in that things have to go up with inflation, or people think that things are going to get so bad because we're going to have to cut quickly. To me, cuts this year is a bad sign. It means that things deteriorated.
Hey, forgive me. I just want to point out, we can't check a share price because Twitter is private, but Elon Musk announcing a new CEO for ex-Twitter. He's transitioning to executive chair and CTO. So again, Elon Musk, not CEO. He's getting a new CEO for ex-Twitter, and he is going to be executive chair and chief technology officer of the company. I don't know.
Who on earth would want that job? Can you imagine? I mean, if you take over as the boss of Twitter, you must know that you're not the boss of Twitter.
All I would say is SpaceX, right? He's had somebody running that, and, you know, it can work. So it could be a little tricky, but nonetheless.
Slightly less public,
Katie,
right? SpaceX.
Katie, this is the world we live in, right? There's headlines coming at us. Some are wacky. Some make sense.
It's called X-Twitter now?
I guess so. I didn't realize.
Musk announces new CEO for X.
You know, he changes his name all the
Twitter.
Time. Katie, again, confusion. There's sometimes confusion when it comes to Twitter and what's going on there, confusion in the market. So how do you trade this, or do you just park it in short-term T-bills or cash under the mattress? I'm being extreme, but, you know, what do you do?
Well, I mean, to be honest, you have to have a diversified approach. And there are things that will move and have moved. We have seen some interesting moves in precious metals. People have been talking about gold. They've been talking about silver. There are some movements in the commodity space that are a little bit more pronounced than what you've seen in stocks and bonds. And I think, unfortunately, that's what I'm saying. You almost have to wait until we have some confirmation for those traditional asset classes. I'm a little bit of a pessimistic person in the sense that I worry about what people are not worrying about. And my worry is the bond market. People think last year was a fluke. If you look in periods with inflation, bonds are a little more sensitive and more challenging. So I think that's what I'm worried about more than anything else.
Meaning how bad it can be?
Yeah, I mean, I think let's just take a simple narrative of inflation staying sticky, but stickier than most people would like. At some point, you start thinking, you know, it takes longer for the effects of the tightening to go through the system. And thus, some of the bonds that you might own may not look as desirable. And I think that's where people have really thought about fixed income as the safety bet. Like, it's always going to be there. But the truth is, it tends to be better when the Fed would stop hiking if the yield curve was steeper. And right now we have it inverted. So that means either bond yields have to go up to match, or that we have to have cuts. And either of those are not super great for bonds in general.
Bill Gross has recommended buying the short end of the curve. And a lot of people are talking about T-bills that mature right around the X date, whenever that is. But the interesting thing to me is, if you own those bonds and then they get a deal, all of a sudden the value of the asset you hold is going to drop like a stone, right?
Yeah, that's a tricky place to be. And I think T-bills, especially with the narrative of thinking about politics and resolution of those issues, for me, that's getting it's getting hard, right? And so I think there's definitely some trades there, but they're going to be much more complex than sort of a simple supply-demand narrative. But I do think that shorter term, or even if you're thinking out into a 1-year horizon, so you kind of think that this may be resolved by then, might make sense if you're worried about the end of the yield curve or the steepener trade.
Bottom line, it's not easy to be an investor right now.
Well, true. That's why they get paid the big bucks.
Exactly. Katie Kaminsky, Chief Research Strategist, Portfolio Manager at Alpha Simplex Group. Great to have you here. Be well. She's joining us, or was joining us, on Zoom from Boston.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business.
from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.